It was 1866, and the work for women's suffrage was at a crossroads. 1866, so just the year before the Civil War had ended, which means that loss and grief had to have been everywhere, right? 10,000 battles had been fought in the Civil War. That was 5 years, 10,000 battles, and over 600,000 lives were lost. Loss and grief had to be everywhere. What it means for two sides of righteousness to each become so hardened that life itself becomes irreparably fractured, as in impossible. This was not, for them, theoretical. Now, for most of the 19th century, the work to end slavery and to secure women the vote, these movements had been deeply intertwined. Frederick Douglass, he was one of the key speakers at the famous suffrage convention in Seneca Falls in 1848. And white and black women, that is like Susan B. Anthony, Olympia Brown, Frances Watkins Brown, Lucy Stone, Mary Livermore, Julia Ward Howe, those are all Unitarians and Universalists. They all worked alongside the formidable, not Unitarian, but still formidable, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. They had been leaders in the push to end slavery for many years leading up to the Civil War. All this work, these movements, these leaders, they had been deeply intertwined until about 1866, when the movements were faced with a choice. See, because in 1866, slavery had been abolished. And Congress went on to pass the 14th Amendment, which required all states to ensure that all people, regardless of race or color or creed, were equal citizens. But this citizenship, it did not mean that they could vote. See, voting as of 1866 was restricted to those citizens who were white and male. And so the question was, would these movements continue to work together for women's suffrage since slavery had ended? Or would they first work to ensure that black men had the vote? Now, I phrase it like this, one or the other, because that was part of the question. Like, should they think of it sequentially? Like, and if so, in what order? Or should they stand together and say it would be all or nothing? Nothing, that is, as in no one wins. That is, no one except the white men who still could vote. I've been thinking a lot about this time in our history in recent months, especially as this year marks the 100th anniversary, you might know, the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, that move that did finally bring women the vote, or at least it brought white women the vote. I'll come back to this later. But I've also been thinking about this moment in our history because I think a lot of today's ethical decisions, like the personal and collective ways that we have to think about what constitutes a moral life, a lot of these find us in a similar ethical quandary, like around strategy or solidarity, or purity, or polarization, or like the practical reasons of realities of what we actually can actually get done and what we cannot. For example, we might believe that healthcare is a human right, right? That is a particularly relevant ethical claim in the days where we're talking about a global health crisis, right? So given that ethical claim, you might think that a single payer is the most ethical path for us to move through, to choose. So But if fighting for single payer means that we ultimately end up only with the status quo because single payer can't actually pass, maybe instead the ethical path would be to compromise. That is, to work for some movement, even if it's not all movement, even if it isn't ideal. I mean, some has to be better than none, right? On the other hand, if we don't ever draw that bright line of justice that says sacrificing any lives to slow progress is actually unacceptable, can we really claim that we are walking the moral path, living the ethical life? As Martin Luther King said, justice delayed is justice denied. Like a lot of people I know, my partner and I, and this year we decided to embark on what you might have heard called a dry January, as in like a break from alcohol for the month of January. We did it for many reasons, not the least of which were health and money. Sobriety, of course, deserves its own sermon, but relevant to this question for today of all and or nothing, what I want to talk about is the different ways that Carrie, my partner, and I each approach this task of not drinking. See, for me, I decided at the start of the month that there was a rule. There was a rule. It was called no alcohol through the whole month of January. That was the rule. And then I agreed within myself to follow that rule. Right, regardless of the circumstances, the context, regardless of whether following the rule would actually lead to a definitive good, and to be honest, in some moments I wasn't sure it did, it didn't matter. The rule was the rule, and following the rule in and of itself was the good. Generally, this way of approaching ethical decisions, moral choices, is what philosophers would call the deontological approach. Deont, as in duty, and logical, as in like the study of. So deontological ethics is that approach, is what is studying what it means to have a duty to a moral life. What is your duty in an ethical life? It's different than what Sean focused on last week. He talked about virtue ethics. Virtue ethics is about what kind of person are you going to be? Deontological ethics doesn't care at all what kind of person you are. It only cares what you do. You might have seen, any of you, it was so interesting, last service none of them had seen it, but have you ever seen that bumper sticker that says, the Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it? Right. It's like, how have you not seen it? I've seen those. Every time I see those, I'm always like, have you even read the Bible? Because, I mean, like that part where it says that if you, for just this is one example, if you say the Lord's name, you should be stoned in public. Like that settles it for you. Anyway, my point is that a book of rules that we need not question but simply follow. This is deontology. This is, of course, what a lot of people expect from a religious community, from religion. It's why we often, when people find out about Unitarian Universalism, they can be kind of confused, because we don't have a book that settles, like, anything. Instead, our origins are more like a reaction against the rules, right? And the idea that an ethical life would or could be tied to a prescriptive, unmoving set of ethical standards. I'm guessing not too many of us are really big on concepts like obedience or submission. On the other hand, demographically, it's interesting, Unitarian Universalists, we tend to have a lot of formal education. And we also tend to be employed in jobs like in science or engineering or math, or IT, or government, all of these things that require that you be really good at following rules. And actually, that you might even like rules, especially if you get to write them yourself. It's maybe why Unitarian Universalists, rural resistors as we are, we can get really into things like bylaws and policies and Robert's Rules of Order, making sure that we are in full compliance with those rules, regardless of what the impact those rules might actually be having, right? The rule itself can become the good. To go back to my own example and my dry January, I have to say the rule, it was a relief. You know, to have made that one decision and then just to be faithful to that commitment, regardless of the swirling ups and downs of any given day, the news cycle, the tweets, whatever, just to follow the rule. It could be a... It's this sort of gift that actually we mean to be giving ourselves in a marriage commitment. That's another example. To decide at the outset, regardless of what comes, I'm in. I will be a partner to this person out of a sense of duty, even obedience, not necessarily in a patriarchal sense, but more in a sense of submitting to that promise that you yourself made. Sean's actually going to talk more about the ethical choices of marriage next week. His message is called The Ethical Affair. Come back next week to find out more. But the example of marriage reminds us that to be duty-oriented in creating an ethical life, it isn't just about having rules, like in a very detailed sense. Instead, we can set our loyalty to something much more broad, to a sense of what goodness and morality means in a much grander sense, to decide that there are principles or maxims, as Immanuel Kant framed it, maxims that, like, if you've committed to them, regardless of the specific circumstances or the particular impact that those principles would have in a particular context, to choose to remain dutiful to their promise. This too is deontology, and it can be a gift. This is where I imagine Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were in this place after the Civil War. See, they had a principle about women and the vote. They had a sense of duty. They were irrevocably committed. Regardless of the impact that any of that commitment would have, they were all in. See, I said earlier that the women's movement, they had this choice. They had to decide between taking one issue at a time, or standing together and ensuring that suffrage, regardless of race or sex, was either all secured or not secured at all. See, it turns out that this was not how Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton saw their choice at all. Instead, Stanton and Anthony and those who followed them decided that their all or nothing was in their commitment to women's suffrage, period. See, in the years following the Civil War, they and other women, they had the sense that they'd fulfilled their duty, their work for Black people. Like, slavery was over. And so now it was time to focus on women's suffrage. So much so that they worked to directly oppose what became the 15th Amendment, which granted Black men to vote. They opposed it because it didn't include women. As Brent Staples wrote recently in the New York Times, in the years after the Civil War, Stanton embarked on a Klan-like tirade against the amendment. She warned that white women would be degraded if Negro men preceded them into the franchise. The rhetoric in attempting to assert the absolute right of white women to vote became often ugly, petty, racist, fear-mongering. They happily accepted funding and primary support from a virulent racist banker who published their journal, stinking, probably a journal that many of us have loved and respected. So this banker, he relished not that their work would lift up white women, per se, but more that it just would lift up white people, period. As you might guess, However, not everyone in the women's movement saw this as the right approach, including not all white women. To explain the alternative, I need to go back to our dry January. Like I said, see, Carrie had a different approach than my rule-based approach. For her, the idea of removing the active choice, it didn't feel like a gift. It actually just felt more like a prison. It increased her anxiety and made her feel much like she was less likely to accomplish what we'd set out to do. So instead, Carrie approached each opportunity to have a drink or not have a drink as an individual choice, where she decided based on would the actual result in her of her choice, what good would that do? Would that choice result in more good? She called it intentional drinking. I was skeptical, but in nearly all cases, she chose again and again not to drink. It's just that her ways of approaching the decision was a lot more focused on the outcome of the commitment rather than the commitment itself. Carrie's ethical frame is either called a consequentialist or a teleological. Sorry, they all have very long names. Consequentialist or teleological, but really you can just think of it as it's focused on the ends, the result, as a way of deciding what's good. If the choice you make results in a greater freedom, justice, pleasure, happiness for more people, then your choice was a good choice, an ethical choice. Voting is often considered through a consequentialist lens. Especially this voting cycle, it seems like voters have expressed this desire to be strategic, to think practically about the ends that we can realistically accomplish, regardless of whether a given candidate aligns in a deeper sense with what you actually believe is right or good. It only really matters what will actually happen, the actual end. This is voting as a harm reduction, which is another form of consequentialist ethics. Harm reduction, that is to accept that something is going to remain mostly not good, that reality can't change. And so what we can do is just try to reduce the negative impact, reduce the harm. Reducing the harm is the good. Whereas deontology doesn't recognize different degrees of wrongness, right? Because you just have the rule, you either follow the rule or you don't follow the rule. Consequentialism thinks it's obvious some wrongs are worse wrongs, right? And being less worse may not be good, but it's still better than nothing. This was the calculation made by the other leaders in the women's movement, those who opposed Stanton and Anthony. People like Lucy Stone, Julia Ward Howe, Mary Livermore, as well as a coalition of women and men of all races. They were appalled by the hardliners and their willingness to just disregard the needs of people of color so quickly, and their staunch insistence on women's suffrage or nothing else. This subgroup celebrated the progress that was represented by the 15th Amendment, which secured black men the vote in 1870. They believed that this was a critical first step to ensure not just women's social equality with men, but the literal survival of black people post-Civil War. After the 15th was passed, this group continued its inclusive, harm reduction-oriented work. They focused on a state-by-state, gradualist strategy for change. Within a few years, though, the celebrity of Stanton and Anthony, I'm guessing, like, those are the names you know, right? Their celebrity, their leadership, their power, it eclipsed this other group's efforts. So it was their approach that won the day. Racism and white supremacy became synonymous with white feminism, strengthening the systemic sublimation of women of color for the next century. As Staples writes, historians rightly warning groups involved in suffrage commemorations. Historians are rightly warning groups involved in suffrage commemorations this year not to overstate the significance of the 19th Amendment. It covered the needs of middle-class white women quite nicely, but it meant very little to black women in the South, where most lived at the time, and where election officials were well practiced in the art of obstructing Black access to the ballot box. As African American women streamed in to register, Southern officials merely stepped up their levels of fraud and intimidation. And by this time, the former suffragists in the North were celebrating the amendment and were uninterested in fighting discrimination against women who were suffering racial as opposed to gender discrimination. In our world today, we are faced almost daily with this question of how and when to compromise, and whether to fight for what our hearts are most oriented to, or to concede that most everything, I guess it must be just a matter of harm reduction. This story of post-Civil War activism reminds us that if we are going to engage in that deontological frame, it matters to whom and to what we have pledged our obedience. And maybe even more, it matters whose good we are purposefully or inadvertently willing to sacrifice through this loyalty. As Jonathan Haidt says, morality blinds and binds us. Morality blinds and binds us, as in binds us to those who think exactly as we do and blinds us to all the other ways we might approach a given ethical situation. By which I mean, I admire those hard-line women, the women suffragist leaders. I respect them, and I'm not totally convinced that I wouldn't have been one of them. Without their sense of duty, their courage, and their commitment, their sacrifice, I don't know if we would be celebrating the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment this year, which means I must also acknowledge I don't know if we would be here without their racism. And on the other hand, if those same leaders had been willing to go the route of the consequentialists who celebrated the 15th Amendment and worked to be more gradual, more practical, if they'd remained in relationship with the Black community and refused the racist rhetoric as a strategy, and instead use their social power as white women to form a coalition, maybe instead of the 100th anniversary of women voting, we'd be celebrating the 150th anniversary of women voting. And imagine what world Martin Luther King would have showed up into if those women's all or nothing stance actually meant all. In these days of overwhelming ethical complexity, this is the promise of our faith. That we are bound up in loyalty to all, which means all, the whole world. All of us are free or none of us are free, which doesn't mean that we don't need to compromise or choose the least bad option. Sometimes this duty requires exactly that. But what it also means is that in this faith, we dedicate our lives. We dedicate our lives to the proposition that when we are faithful in this commitment to the whole, together we can draw that bright line of justice that leads not to a partial or temporary freedom for some, but a liberation that gets us all free all of the time. It is the promise of our faith, and it is our call to an ethical life. May it be so, and amen.